Okay, Namu Myoho Rengekyo, thank you so much for being here. Today, I'm going to continue a discussion. I think it's a continuation. It stands on its own, and you may watch this one first. I'm going to link to the body-mind or body versus mind discussion that I put up yesterday in the description. Which one you watch first? It depends on how you think. But today, I'm going to tackle the huge, I think it's huge, disparity in understanding when it comes to the periods, the five periods of Shakyamuni's teachings. Or another way to put it is, what's this Hinayana? What's this Mahayana? What's early Mahayana? What's late Mahayana? What's Theravada? What's Tripitaka? What's all these different, are they different Buddhisms? Are they competing religious practices? What the heck's going on? What is Buddhism in a way? Or the teaching of it anyway? Well, first of all, let me tell you, you're not unique in your misunderstanding of this. There's a tremendous amount of propaganda by different sectors of the teachings, because like all humans, like all monkey mind, samsaric human minds, we tend to be territorial in our thinking, in our living, in our workspaces, in our lives. I don't think I need to describe that. I think it's kind of obvious, isn't it? I mean, our entire sports structure, sports, is built around this competition for place. Anyway, when I say, and I've caught myself saying something I want to describe, when I say human mind, I don't mean to mislead you into thinking that there is over here a human mind and over here a Buddha mind. Language does this segregating because this is the way humans do things. But the fact of the matter is the Buddha mind and the human mind are the same mind. They are shifts in consciousness. They are shifts in perception, or the way we use the mind. And that's important to understand as we get started here, because I'm going to, and please don't get angry with me, but I think when there's this much confusion about something, I think it can be helpful to oversimplify. Because I think in if they're done well, simplifications can lead you by the hand to these very simple insights from observations. And that's, I think, what simplicity is. Can you, in your life, think for a moment, perceive for a moment, a very simple experience, very basic, that you can go, well, of course I get hungry. Well, of course we all get hungry. Of course we all eat to feed that hunger. Oh, of course we need to eat to have energy, right? Just observational, you want to call them truths? Fine. You want to call them facts? Fine. Buddhism struggles all along with this idea of labels, how we label things. And I talk about it all the time, because a lot of my frustration in Buddhism has been the westernization and the labels put on ideas. And even Shakyamuni, 3,000 years ago, was struggling with his students being obsessed about the labeling of things instead of trying to grasp the concept, the idea, the message, the meaning behind the words. Don't get stuck on the words. So from the get-go, this was Shakyamuni's problem. And he perceived it pretty darn quickly. I mean, he spent 6-7 years going through every manner of body torture and mind torture to try to arrive at this fundamental what? That's the first step right there. His goal was to somehow eliminate or greatly minimize the suffering of human life that just seemed to be a component of human life. Sorry, my computer is distracting me. Monkeys. All right. So, you've heard me say before, if you watch my channel for a length of time, videos about the basics of Buddhism, this original goal, how do we get suffering out of the basic component of human life? How do we get rid of this so that we can live a beautiful, self-actualized, if you will, language again, labels, a happy life. Not happy, ha ha ha, but a life that's free to be in awe and joyful of being alive without constantly worrying about rent and relationships and our health and sickness and worrying about death and what's going to happen when we die and where do we go and da, da, da. All of this is a malaise. It's a dis-ease, right? The word dis-ease. I'm sorry I keep blinking, but I'm still dealing with that chemical burn in my eye, and it also is congesting me, so please bear with me. I hope I'm intelligible through this, but I have to talk about this. It's part of my Buddhist practice and part of yours as well, really. Human beings are pattern makers. There's a statement you've heard me say many times, and I've taken it apart many ways, but consider that for a moment. Think about that. When you get up in the morning, there's a certain agenda that pops into your mind, the must-dos. Even if your must-dos are sinking into the couch and smoking marijuana and watching ridiculous horror movies all day, whatever it is, I'm not judging. I'm just saying that human beings, we recognize, we categorize, and we create patterns. And if you go back to pre-civilization, right, historical, tribal, or even pre-tribe, men and women were concerned about, humans were concerned about eating, sex, shelter, and then the list goes out from there, right? Hunting, territorial, gathering, hunter-gatherer, right? You hear all these terms, but think about the thinking that's involved in that. And all of this kind of thinking, as we evolve as a species, is based on one central point. I'm simplifying. This body, right? Feed this body. Satiate the desires of this body. Make more bodies. Have sex. Relationships. Hang on to what you got. Don't let her have it. Don't let him have it. Shelter. This is my shelter. Don't you come in here. You sit out in the rain. This is my shelter. This is what I'm sheltering. This body. Everything else. The wonder of that experience, of that rudimentary life, based on compartmentalizing the body. Its health, its excitement, its dreams. There are still in certain regions of the world, tribes, rudimentary peoples that believe that their dream life is exactly the same or even more real than this daily bodily existence. Why do you think that is? Because that's, is that the body? Is it? They think so. They think themselves flying around and interacting with all sorts of fantasies is just as real as this conversation we're having right now, albeit electrons flying through the wires in the air and satellites. Boggles the mind when you think about it. Because when you're that focused on food, I want to use trigger words here, but I'm because I'm comfortable with them, but I realize that they're not comfortable to everyone. So, okay. We just had a Windows update, and so everything in my computer system seems to be like discovering itself. So I apologize for the background noises. But back on topic. Comfort, shelter, relationships, sex, food, very, very immediate gratification, body gratification. But the mind is the mind, and the mind is looking around and has many challenges to that body perception. Even rain, what the hell is that coming down from the sky? Can I collect it? Can I drink it? How does that work in my life? Thunder. The sky is angry, right? I feel it bodily, thunder, right? Think about these kinds of things, environmental, that still are perceived through the body. But nonetheless, because they're not made of the body, seems pretty mystical, unknown, containing magic, right? So from that comes our mystical imagination, like dreams, but experienced right here and now with our bodies. Everything's in reference to the body. So the way we know the world carries through us through tens of thousands of years is through our bodily experience of it. Even what we see in our visions is a eye consciousness. But the consciousness part is not something we think about. We just take that for granted. We're just big tools of experience. We're just readouts from the equipment. We don't recognize the equipment. And in Buddhism, that's what we focus on, is the equipment, the mind that perceives, cognates, and categorizes and collects data and compares it and makes decisions on it. That mind is the focus of Buddhism. But imagine Shakyamuni coming to that enlightenment and understanding that all human suffering comes from the conjuring that's going on in the mind. The groupings of conjuring that are human mind, same mind. If we just shift the perspective, the perceptive filter of that same mind toward not that, then what we see and experience in this life, oh, it's free of all of that suffering, all of that attachment. It's the attachment, that's what it is. When our mind creates this hard data and says, this is the only way it is, and it cannot be changed, I will not let it change, I will hang on to it forever and ever and seek it in every moment. Oh, that's how we create suffering in our life. If we simply just go and look over here, we see all the same stuff, but we experience it without this desperation, this craving, this constant permanentizing, without this obsession, this obsessive, territorial, holding on to, possessive craving. That's the source of all suffering. We need to change our mind. It's kind of like waking up from a sleeping, dreaming state where dragons are chasing us, ghosts are coming up out of the ground and grabbing at our legs, and we're running in desperation, and then we wake up and we go, oh, right? It's an awakening. So what does Shakyamuni do with this situation? First of all, he's excited as heck. He's just figured it out. So he starts explaining this amazing thing that is awakening. It looks like this. It changes your tongue and your taste and your eyes and your ears. It's so amazing. And all of his close inner circle is looking at him like, what are you talking about? Well, we trust you. It must be amazing. But, okay then. I have no idea how I'm supposed to do that. And so Shakyamuni, it doesn't take him but a couple of weeks of delivering this sermon of amazing awakening that he suddenly awakens to something else. Oh, yeah. I went through 3, 6, 7 years of craziness in order to figure this out. I need to retrace my steps, and I need to teach those steps in a controlled fashion that makes sense and supports the goal. Right? Makes perfect sense. So he backs up and he goes, okay, first order of business. You guys, you don't even understand how your mind and body instantiate each other. I mean, oh my goodness. The whole idea, the whole process, right? The Nidana and all of that you've heard me talk about. I'm not going to repeat all that here. But suffice it to say that everything that ends up creating a you and me is all physical, except that it kind of has its origins in a mental construct. That mental construct being the desire to experience that very thing of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, taste consciousness, right? It's all broken down in Buddhism. Nowhere else. We talk about Freud, we talk about consciousness and subconsciousness, and maybe another level, an astral plane. We put all kinds of labels on these different aspects of what we think consciously is going on in our mind. Buddhism takes it all the way to 9 levels of consciousness and actually breaks down our bodily consciousness in vision, sound, taste, feeling, smell. Those are our first, our rawest consciousnesses. But all of those consciousnesses are speaking to and forming manifestation of much deeper levels of knowing, of experiencing, that we kind of gloss over because our bodily fascination is through this immediate interface of touch, smell, eyes, hearing, right? So Shakyamuni goes, well, that's the first thing to teach people. The first level of capacity that these people need to get beyond in order to be able to get ultimately to the Amala consciousness. That aspect of the mind that can free itself from the adherence and the craving for those other things. Stop trying to satiate all those things. Just observe what they're doing. With the appreciation and the knowledge that they are precipitant from this craving of experience. Stop being so attached to them. Let them just be. Observe them as the amazing and folly that they all are. Because that's not reality. That's what you're hanging on to with desperation. Let it go. And look at how amazing all of this is. But that requires a major mental shift, and you guys are simply not ready to even think that way, right? So he starts the first period of teachings. And you have things like privations, asceticism, and this is where the first level of mistakes happen for the early Buddhist student. Because every religion that man has ever created, pagan, Islam, Christ, Jew, whatever, Kabbalah, mysticism, Jainism, Hinduism, anyism, are all man grappling with what seems unknowable. Buddhism isn't about the unknowable, it's about the knowable. So right off the bat, that's not religion. Religion is concerned with mysticism, magical thinking. And in that way, it's so not evolved. You might as well be a hairy, cave-dwelling Neanderthal. Because that's the level of thinking of religion. It's totally bodily focused. And when you start learning Buddhism, you may see verbiage, words that make you think, oh, it's in Buddhism too. It's not so hard to move to Buddhism from Catholicism because there it is, fetishes of the body. Because in early teachings of Buddhism, there's this starvation thing. Don't speak for a year. Don't be around others for a year. Totally remove yourself from the opposite sex. Sequester yourself in a concrete building. Learn how to starve. Learn how to only get food from people around you. Don't forage. Don't hunt. Don't have sex. The only thing we'll give you is shelter, and that shelter is to also shelter you mentally. We're going to deprive, deprive, deprive. And so you go, wow, that's comfortable. Just same torture as I've ever known. But it's not for the same reason. The reason, and this is why those teachings no longer apply in later teachings of Buddhism, because in the early teachings of Buddhism, what Shakyamuni was trying to get people in raising their capacity to understand that was what was actually at work with those cravings, those bodily cravings, was in the mind. It wasn't about depriving the body. It was about developing a relationship with the way these cravings are formed in the mind. You look at an early meditation sutra like the Suragama Sutra, and it talk about watching the breath going in and watching it move through the body. And immediately talks about ceasing things. And that's all you read in it. Most people read that as cease this, cease that, cease that. But you miss the key word, formations. You want proof that what I'm saying is correct? Go read the Surangama and read the chapter on meditating. And you can read, even in the Western translations, the words cease the formations of these kinds of thoughts. Cease the formation of thoughts on sex, thoughts on hunger, thoughts on this, thoughts on that. It's about the mind. So first, his meditation is about calming everything down. Isolate. And then observe your mind. You feel hunger? Ask yourself, where's that feeling of hunger coming from? How am I formulating that in my body from my mind? How can I interrupt that perceptive catapult from thought of food to growling stomach? Where can I intervene in there? There's a forming thought there. How does it form? Where does it form from? How does it manifest in my body? Do you see that those privations of early Buddhist practice are often called the precepts? They're just rules of behavior enforcing internal perception of how you and your mind create your experience of life. This was the first steps of getting people's capacity to rise to the questioning level that would be required in order to move on to more profound questions about existence. You can't understand how life is suffering if you don't understand how suffering is created in the mind. It doesn't, your body doesn't create suffering. Your mind does. And your mind and body are so intertwined that in order to understand how to free yourself from that intertwined mess, you have to address that it exists, number one, and then you can start to take it apart bit by bit. Not kill it off, but stop intertwining it with your experience of life. There's the experience of life, and there's this bodily manifestation, and the two are separate, but deeply related. The human mind versus the Buddha mind. And this is the lesson of the various periods of teachings. It's not that this is the true Buddhism and that is some other thing for special people or vice versa. The teaching of Buddhism is all of it, but the proper practice of Buddhism is the Buddhism at its ultimate teaching that provides for your awakening of Buddhahood, because that's what it's all about, is detaching from that earthly physical obsession and manifesting this freed Buddha mind. Now, you could argue, and many have over the centuries, that in those early privations in a concrete room with no light and none, you know, blah, 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 you could attain your Buddha mind. To which one would have to say, well, maybe, but the likelihood? That's astronomical. That simply by doing that, you could go, oh, I don't need to do this. I mean, we just don't work that way. And more to the point, today, latter day of the law, today, the levels of constant distraction that we attach ourselves to, all I need to say to you is, Apple, Microsoft, I mean, a billion attachments, right? People call that a religious argument. Why? Because it's mystical, the degree to which we will attach to one side or the other. Or even attach ourselves to the ambiguity of the middle. We're so persistent in our territorialness, in our bodily manifestation of everything. And today, we have more everything than ever before. So in this latter day of the law, when the Shakyamuni said, that day will come when we're completely driven by our cravings, our greed, our avarice, more. We never have enough. Ever. Right? Anger, manipulations to get more. Backstabbing, contriving, changing laws, lobbyists, blah, blah, blah. All about more. More attachments. And foolishness, stupidity. In Buddhism, what is that? That is a failure to recognize that we're being driven by our own cravings, our animal cravings, and failing to recognize that we have a higher ability, a higher potential, a higher perceptive fulfillment. We just completely obliterated to our earthly avarice. More sex, more food, more stuff, better housing. I want a house on the moon. I want money, money. There can't be enough money. I want it all. That's the age we live in. And so for that age, simply going on a diet isn't going to create enlightenment. Do you see what I did there? This privation of food that 3,000 years ago meant real suffering is now a game. I'm on the pineapple diet. I just eat pineapples for 30 days and I'm going to lose weight. Yeah, you're not feeding your body. But that's just a ritual now. And that's why we have every now and again, by the way, speaking of diets, we'll have a diet that comes out and says, all those diets are fads and you have to change your attitude about food. There's a little glimpse of light there. It says, yes, give credit to the mind. How you think about feeding yourself is more important than what you feed yourself. But those diets, they never seem to stick around very long, do they? Because people don't like to be bothered. That's too much effort. This is the amazing thing about Lotus Sutra, about Myoho Renge Kyo. Does it make it easy? No. It's still going to take consistency and effort, because effort without consistency just doesn't do anything. It's just momentary, right? But the difference is that in Myoho Renge Kyo, we're no longer focused on controlling the mechanisms of body. In the Lotus Sutra, as Bodhisattva way to attain Buddha, we simply invoke it. We place ourselves in it. Now, if 3,000 years ago, when Shakyamuni first started to teach this, he just sat there in modern parlance and said, you guys, all you need to do to attain enlightenment is change your mind. Just do it. Could you imagine? People would just walk away. Just do it. Okay, thanks. Right? He had to teach them how to do it. And so earlier teachings, middle teachings, they're all on the path of getting to the how. But it doesn't necessarily do a lot of good to know how if you don't know what it is you're achieving in the how. I could stick a 7-year-old in any car, show him where the keys are. Well, now it's just a push button. And say, okay, that makes it go. That starts it, that makes it go, and that's how you move it around. Cool. Vroom. How long is it going to take before that 7-year-old runs off the road or into something or kill someone? Or what are you trying to accomplish in this vehicle? Okay, now I'm starting to understand, right? I don't know. Maybe this will be the used car analogy. I don't know. Anyway, does that make sense? So when Buddhism says smaller vehicle, larger vehicle, one vehicle, right? Lesser teachings, essential teachings, provisional teachings, all those words and labels are defining this way of knowing, this way of shifting from the human perceptive mind to understanding those perceptions as manifestations of the Buddha mind to be, then sit back and be. Instead of being craving in the being. At this point, I'm just going to start repeating myself with other words. Isn't that what analogies are, right? But I know this is an oversimplification, so please try to digest what I'm talking about, because I know a lot of, even if you've been practicing for many years, letting go of that idea of the body-centric thinking, it isn't natural. Our natural tendency as humans is to defend, nurture, support, crave bodily things. So Buddhism stands aside from that. It's a complete ungluing of that. Now, even within Buddhism, because we are human, you will hear rhetoric. You will read rhetoric in translations, in discussions, in sermons, analogies using the body. Why? Because that's the most natural reference point for a human. Not because Buddhism is about the body. The body is used as a tool for understanding. When Buddhism says things like, and I know it's quixotic, but hear me out. When you read that certain personages, remember, they're imagined people, not actual people. When the medicine king, come on, who's a medicine king? Oh, it's a doctor. It's just an idea, a personage, a straw man. Burns his flesh just to hear the teachings of Buddhism. That doesn't mean, oh, I'll understand how to awaken Buddha if I go out and set my arm to flame. That's what I mean. The most natural thing for a human to do is to think human, is to think body. When Shakyamuni tells this story of the medicine king, he's not promoting that lighting one's flesh on fire equals understanding Buddhism and gaining enlightenment. He's making an analogy, and he's saying, look, if you are willing to depart from this earthly core, from depart from your attachment, don't love your skin with ointments and so on and so forth, and just set it aside as something that you don't need to obsess about anymore. Instead, shift your focus to your enlightenment, your Buddha mind of clarity. This is no longer an obsession. It's not something you have to have. That doesn't mean eliminate it. That doesn't mean light it a fire, literally. It means discard it as part of your earthly realm and focus your mind on the experience not the attachment and the obsession with flesh, but the experience of it at a distance. Remove yourself from it, the body, and stay in the mind, and everything will be clear. You'll no longer be obsessed, attached, pained by issues of the body. So in that sense, the body is very much a tool of learning in Buddhism, but it's not about the body. It's about the attitude, the perception, the experience of. I hear myself saying these words and I'm thinking, if you're not ready to hear what I'm saying, you'll just keep doing what you're doing. But I'm hoping that somehow, through not the words necessarily, but the passion with which I talk about this, my conviction when I talk about this, somehow shifts your perspective of from the words to what is meant. In the teachings, in what I'm saying, but overall the Dharma. The Dharma isn't a thing. The Dharma is an experience, an observation of the thing as a separate experience. Not an experience of the thing, an experience separate from the experience of the thing. The mental conjuring that is the source of the bodily conjuring. It's more than a mind over matter situation. It's a mind observing the mind over the matter. But the first step is to understand that there's a difference between matter and mind. Then you can understand how the mind produces the matter. But if you can get in between there to cease the formation of the matter from the mind, now you have a third mind. You have a mind that's observing the mind creating the matter. That's the Buddha mind. Because it's no longer attached to that process. It becomes an observer. And a welling of appreciation and awe comes from that perspective of detachment, profound appreciation and wonder and what word. And this is where we come to, it can only be shared amongst Buddhas, right? Right straight from the sutra. Only if you achieve that mental perspective can you know what it is to have that mental perspective. Everything else is a feeder tube, a funnel to get you to that place. Myoho Renge Kyo. Oh boy, I've gone on and on again. I hope this helps, or at very least raises some of your personal struggles or questions with this. Use the comments section, let me know what those are, and I'll dive into them. And we'll solve this puzzle together. Because it's all about Myoho Renge Kyo. It's all about your Buddha. Awaken that thing. Because it's already there. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you for participating in this grand experiment, this sangha, this arduous effort to awaken and minimize our suffering in this life, actualize our greatest potential. Whew, it's a big one. So thank you for being here. And I'll leave a link to Body and Mind in the description. Maybe I'll put it in the end. Anyway, thank you for being here. Download the podcasts. I'm so proud of you guys for your efforts. Even the part of your effort that's listening to me. And with that, I'll see you in the next one. Thank you so much.